PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Thanks to the friends of WILL, whose contributions have helped us maintain a strong program schedule in 2004. Your gifts support almost half our annual operating budget. If you appreciate the programs but haven't yet contributed, consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Write a check to the Friends of WILL Radio and mail it to the University of Illinois Foundation, Box 3429, Champaign, 61826. Thank you, and happy holidays.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our guest today is Richard Yancey. For a dozen years, when he was on the job, he didn't use that name. He used a pseudonym. The work he did required it. He worked, as he describes it, as a foot soldier in the most feared, hated, and maligned agency in the federal government. He worked for the Internal Revenue Service. So on the program today, we'll get a glimpse of the life of a revenue officer. Richard Yancey is the author of Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Richard Yancey. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Before joining the IRS, Richard Yancey worked as a ranch hand, typesetter, convenience store clerk, adjunct professor, actor, and director. His book, Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS, now available in paperback, published by Perennial, a division of HarperCollins. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Richard Yancey, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Celeste. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing good. Really.
Good.
How's things in Illinois? I used to live up that way. I used to live in Chicago.
Really?
Yeah.
It's cold.
It's cold. Yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah, and you're still in Florida now, are you?
No, I relocated up to the Upper South. I live in Tennessee near the Kentucky border.
Oh, okay.
And it's cold here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet that cold air reaches pretty far south
today. Yeah, it's cold here today.
Yeah. Well, prior to going to work for the IRS, as I mentioned, you had a lot of jobs.
Oh, yeah. Well, I need to clarify something with the ranch hand. Actually, that was a family business that that my dad owned, and that was sort of my summer work, was to do some cow poking. But it fit in well with being a freelanced writer, because I had a lot of free time in between gathering up the cows and feeding them to write.
Well, tell us how it was that you went to work for the IRS.
I needed a job. I had been working for quite a few years in the arts, directing and acting, and I wanted something with a little bit more stable income. And it's odd. I was just looking through the paper one Sunday, and there was an advertisement for a government job. It didn't mention the IRS. It said it was with the Department of Treasury. And it offered a salary that was about three times what I had made in the past 3 years combined. So they didn't say what the work was, but it just said that I needed a college degree and invited me to sort of this open house. And it wasn't until I arrived there that evening that I realized it was the IRS.
Yeah, and you stayed.
And I stayed. I stayed for 12 years. It's been a year and 2 months and about 17 days since I left.
Wow. That sounds like something that, you know, somebody familiar with a 12-step program would do, count the years and days.
Well, I tell you, there was rarely a day when I did not feel at some part of me like the, you know, proverbial fish out of water. The IRS instituted a different sort of hiring program just before they hired me, which they called the Outstanding Scholars Program. And in the collection division of the IRS, most of the collectors had risen through the ranks. They had started as clerks, or actually out of a high school program that the IRS ran, or they were retired military types. And at some point, someone in Washington decided, you know, collection is becoming more and more complex. The tax law is becoming, with each year, more and more complex. Maybe we should consider actively recruiting college graduates, and we'll require a certain grade point average. And since it isn't really accounting-oriented collection, let's just get them from all backgrounds. And that's sort of what made my getting on board there possible. They didn't care whether my degree was in English. They didn't care if it was, you know, in English or animal husbandry or accounting. They didn't care as long as you had a grade point average that was 3.5 or above and you passed the interview process.
So other than that, the grade point average and getting through the interview process, did you need any kind of qualifications for the job?
I don't know exactly what they were looking for, and I'm not really sure they knew either. I think they wanted bright, articulate people who could grasp, you know, complex material fairly quickly. And that was it. That was the only parameters they set for themselves. So they did get a ride, you know, people from, you know, varying backgrounds. Although I will say most of the people that were hired when I did have some sort of business degree or business experience. To my knowledge, I was the only one in that whole area that you know, had the kind of background that I did.
Yeah. We have a listener waiting to talk with us already, so let's go to this caller who's in Terre Haute on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I'm not sure if he's going to know the answer. Years ago, my employer didn't withhold taxes because he thought I was a self-employed employee, which I wasn't. I got a ruling against him, but they continued. I had a lien against me. And for years and years and years, when I should get a refund, they took money out. And, of course, taxes or penalties accrued, and the amount got to be quite large. And I know I never paid it off, but about 3 or 4 years ago, I sent my tax return in, and lo and behold, I got a return. And for every year after that, I've gotten a return. What's going on? Have they forgot about me or lost my...
The IRS never forgets.
Yeah, I know.
Never forgets. Well, it depends on how far back this goes. If it's over 10 years and they never asked you to sign a waiver...
It's over 15.
Yeah, then the statute of limitations for collection has expired. Or as we used to say on the job, the statute's blown. And when the statute blows, that's it. The IRS can't come after you anymore.
You're kidding me.
So you can sleep well tonight.
Well, I've been sleeping well, but well, I didn't. But if I go and look in the credit bureau, it still shows a lien against me.
Yeah, and sometimes that will, and I would suggest that you get in contact with your credit bureau. When the IRS files a lien, those are by law self-releasing, which means the IRS doesn't have to come up behind itself and file a release every time the 10-year statute goes on a lien.
Uh-huh.
That's to save the government money. And if you look at the actual body of the lien, it says on there, you know, this is a self-releasing document. On such and such a date, this lien will no longer, you know, be in effect.
If
the credit union has a problem with that, you can always go to your local courthouse, wherever it's filed, and pull a copy of it and you know, note that on it and send it to your credit bureau. And at least in the least they should do is attach it to your report for anybody that asks.
But after 10 years, it just goes away.
It's gone. And usually the IRS starts to panic about the ninth year. During my career, that was a lot of our casework. We'd get those, what they called statute cases. And we were really supposed to go out and be aggressive, either to get the taxpayer into signing a waiver, which means getting them to extend the statute to give us more time to collect, or to go ahead and take, you know, harsh enforcement action to get as much as we could before the statute, you know, went away.
Well, that's good news.
Well, good.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, a former tax collector, Richard Yancey. He's the author of Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-2000. 9455. Well, what was it about the IRS that kept you for those years? You stayed quite a while.
Yeah, they would call it inside the service the golden handcuffs. Really, when you think of, once you got into the job, you realized how much they were compensating you for a very, you know, small amount of work. Really, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to be a tax collector. You have basically three big tools at your disposal to collect taxes, and once you master those, it's very easy work. I had the person who ended up hiring me told me in the final hiring interview. He said you won't believe how much money we're going to be paying you to collect taxes. You'll be getting more once you reach, you know, the highest level of tax collector. You'll be getting more money than most lawyers do in this country, and it's true. And that's why a lot of people stayed. I did not know very many people throughout my 12 years there that were happy working at the IRS or even particularly proud, but they were there for the benefits and they were there for the good money that you earned, you know, doing what you did. And it was possible for, you know, not to perpetuate the stereotype of the pencil pushing, you know, power hungry bureaucrat who's in a cushy job, but, you know, a lot of that does and did go on at the time I was there. It's a very seductive place to be. First of all, you feel like you're in the know, because with just a few clicks on a keyboard, you can know practically anything about anybody anywhere, not only in America but in any country in the world, and you rule the people's lives that you're dealing with. You tell them how much they can spend for groceries. You tell them whether or not they can send their kids to private school. You have absolute authority over everybody's lives that you touch. And for a lot of people, that's extremely seductive. The irony is that it's those people that really get into that sort of thing that rise in the service, because that usually means their personality is geared to such where they just want to accumulate more and more power. And the people now who set policy within the IRS and direct how taxes are collected are those people that succeeded in, if you will, you know, being the most successful bullies out in the field.
Mm. So a lot of people stay with the IRS until retirement then?
Oh yes. I was, it's sort of rare what I did, because the benefits are so good, and you do have such a, you know, a nice benefit package with health insurance and the 401k that they have, and the fact that you know now about 5 years before I left, they instituted FlexiPlace, which is, you know, being able to work from your home. And a lot of revenue officers would disappear for weeks at a time, you know, reporting in that they were working from home, and you just, you know, you wouldn't see anybody. So it's also, you got to understand, a hard job to, you know, especially when you're first hired. The real crucial time is that training year, which takes up about, I don't know, three quarters of my book,
mm-hmm.
because that's the crucible. That's when they really figure out, you know, if they want to keep you, and you can really figure out if you want to stay. And at least when I went through training, they didn't try to hide things, you know, what the nature of the job is for me. They it was trial by fire, sort of the idea of throwing you into the pool and seeing if you could swim.
Now, while you were there, then after that, on the job training part of things, and then as you were there over the years, did that climate change?
It did change a little bit, and I think it varies from region to region. I think the IRS is such a huge culture. You know, after all, it's the largest federal employer outside of the military, and it's such a huge organization that I think in different areas or regions, at least the ones I came across in my tour, have different cultures and mindsets. But where I was brought up, if you will, or trained, it was very, you know, heavily enforcement-minded, you know, let's go get them, taxpayers are deadbeats, you know, it's us against them. It was an entire kind of war mentality. But then it changed a little bit when Commissioner Rosati came on board, when he was put in. And then it changed radically in the late 90s, in 98, when the Revenue Restructuring Act was passed by Congress and signed by President Clinton. That was a legislative attempt to change the culture of the IRS. And it did have a big effect, at least in procedurally how we did things. Now the pendulum is starting to swing back. The present commissioner, Mark Everson, is giving directions to the field now. We're going to get back in the collection business. Yes, Congress has created all these hoops, extra hoops that collection has to jump through, but we're going to go ahead and jump through them because, you know, the IRS has got a big concern about compliance right now, that people are looking around them and they're seeing that their neighbors are, you know, getting away with not reporting everything. They see successful businesses that cut corners and seem to get away with not paying their employment taxes. And so that's the big concern the IRS has right now.
Yeah. This book is very funny, and it's also scary.
Yeah, I like the IRS.
Well, absurdity abounds, that is for sure. Now, you've changed the names of the people you worked with and the names of taxpayers you pursued. Is everything else true?
Yes, everything else that I talk about in the book is true. For legal reasons, I had to change some names and you know, play with some details of taxpayer businesses, for example, to not give away who these people are I'm talking about. But everything else in the book is true. It actually happened.
Well, right from the outset, it's really weird when you step into that office in Florida, that dreary office, for an interview with the man you call Jim Nayland. There are these pictures on the wall. Mm-hmm. One is the Challenger. What's the other one?
The Sunshine Skyway Bridge. I don't know if many people remember that. That certainly, if you're a Floridian, yeah, will remember it. But that was a bridge that collapsed not long after its completion, and several dozens of people died when it collapsed into the bay, Tampa Bay. And those were the two pictures that were hanging on the wall when I was sitting there waiting, it seemed like forever, for the interview to get underway. And I spent the time staring at those two pictures thinking, you know, is this some sort of omen?
Well, after these interviews, you know, I've wondered, this guy still wants the job?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that too was you know, feeling sort of ineffectual. I mean, I suppose some people could argue that's, you know, one of the most, you know, common conditions in modern life is this feeling of powerlessness and you know, ineffectualness. And I certainly, you know, felt that to some degree. And the job really, one of the seductive parts about it is you just feel, for at least those 8 hours, you feel totally in control. I've never been in the military, but, you know, it's Big Brother sitting right next to you and telling you exactly what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And any frustrations in the job that you felt, any sort of, you know, anxiety could always had an outlet in your work. I couldn't tell you how many times I and my coworkers, you know, did the things that the IRS is often accused of, which is taking out our, you know, taking out our frustrations and our problems on the American taxpayer. You know, there's one incident I talk about in the book where I browbeat a coworker into seizing a nursery because I was going through some pretty bad personal problems. I overheard her talking on the phone to the owner of this business, and I lost it, and I marched over to her desk and browbeat her until we ended up that afternoon, that very same afternoon, going out there to seize his business. Would that have happened if I hadn't been having a bad day? I, you know, looking back at it now, I'm not happy to say it probably wouldn't have happened.
Hmm. When you first started, tell us about your first field assignment. You're with Culpepper, and you know, here you are. You're not the man you would become. You're
right.
Not the tax collector you would become. What was it like at the beginning going out and seeing how this all unfolded?
Absolutely terrifying. I mean, everybody's, you know, worst nightmares, like, you know, showing up to school in your underwear, or, you know, the most terrifying experiences that you have are those feelings of dread, like going to a dentist for a root canal. Anything that's, because not only was the situation so foreign to me and so anathema to everything that I had experienced up to that point, but you literally don't know what's going on. And what exacerbates the problem is that the taxpayer usually doesn't know what's going on. So you're two very lost people, you know, kind of floundering around trying to figure out what to do. And it was particularly hard for me in the beginning because, you know, being in the arts, I had, you know, had some proclivity that way, but also have been trained to have, you know, a certain amount of empathy for human beings, and it's a very hard job to do. unless you suspend that feeling, feelings of empathy and you know, understanding, because that's not what you're there for.
Yeah. It seems maybe it's a little bit like the movie that starred Jim Carrey, The Mask. You know, where you maybe at the beginning you can climb into and out of that suit, but
it does become increasingly difficult to separate yourself from what you do. I think I say that somewhere in the book. It hits me that, you know, I have become what I do. What I do is the limit of what I am. And you do start to, or at least I did. I started to see changes in my personality that, you know, didn't stop when I left the office every day. I found myself more aggressive. I found myself quicker to argue, and I certainly found myself more paranoid, seeing plots and ulterior motives to everything around me. And I also discovered, you know, how terribly easy it is, and this is not, you know, an original discovery of mine, but how terribly easy it is to manipulate people. And that's what my job ultimately taught me. Not only that you can, but the ease in which you can manipulate people. And that's a very scary thing. It's scary when you put it in the context of how much power the IRS has, and it's scary in the context of, you know, what it does to human beings. And I think that's, you know, what's kind of unique about my book is that it looks at it from the other side looking out. It looks at it at the toll and the cost of the real human beings who have to do that necessary work that's pretty onerous.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 4 in Eureka. Hi.
Hi. Very interesting. 3 quick questions, if that would be possible.
Okay.
You mentioned 3 enforcement tools. I don't think I heard you specify. Could you state what they are, please?
Yeah. Basically, the 3 enforcement tools of a revenue officer are levy, summons power, and seizure. Although technically seizure is legally still a form of levy, but seizure is the actual physical taking of a physical asset.
Mm-hmm.
When revenue officers refer to levy, they're talking about putting seizing your bank account or taking your wages, something that, you know, doesn't require actually physically going out and stickering something. And a summons is the ability to, it's in effect a subpoena power, where you can on your own authority go out and compel people to produce tax records or compel them to give testimony, compel them to supply you with the financial information, or in some cases with third parties, we wouldn't even be limited by whether they owed taxes or not, but if they just had certain information or we suspected they had certain information, we could summons them to appear before us and give us that information.
And with the seizure?
A seizure is, for example, a taxpayer has a car.
Uh-huh.
And we would go out and seize the car.
Would you give so many days notice before ahead of time, or just a...
Yeah, the law required us a written notice that was sent by certified mail, and then the taxpayer was given 30 additional days to, you know, come to terms with, you know, whatever they owed.
Uh-huh.
And if we couldn't reach an agreement, then they would go out and seize. Now, you know, we spoke earlier about the battle. In the battle days, we used to summons people to come into the office to provide financial information.
Mm-hmm.
When they pulled up with their car, we'd seize their car.
Oh, my gosh.
So we'd compel them to come see us, and when they drove up in their car, we'd just take
their
car.
Yeah, you had power. I knew you had power. I didn't know you had that much. Second question is, and I know this is a broad question, but what would you say the relationship would be between political pressures and the IRS in terms of maybe going after certain people or letting them alone?
Up to about a year ago, I would say very small, but from what I've witnessed since I've left and this book has been published, I would say that it happens, and it probably happens with more frequency and regularity than most people know about.
Uh-huh.
I was on the Bill O'Reilly show, and he opened with, you know, Bill Clinton ordered the IRS to audit me 3 years in a row. What do you think about that? And I poo-pooed the idea at the time, but, you know, now I'm not so sure.
Uh-huh.
I think that the IRS has been and will continue to be used as a tool. And I think within the IRS, they will continue to use their power to whatever extent they feel that they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Final question is, and I guess this is a very broad perception, I think probably widely held, but the IRS focuses on middle and lower income, maybe another way to put it, more vulnerable people who don't have resources of accountants and batteries of lawyers than they do on upper class and corporations. How would you answer that?
I would say absolutely. I'd say that's absolutely correct. It's correct in two senses. One is the tax code itself is focused upon middle-income Americans. You know, it's no big secret that, you know, from in the boom years between 96 and 2000, I think 65% of all American corporations paid no taxes at all, and 75% of them of foreign companies that do business in this country paid no taxes at all. The tax code itself is geared to benefit, you know, the super rich and the powerful corporations. And so as a result of that, you know, the accounts that land in field officers' inventories aren't, you know, we're not going to work Enron. We're going to work the mechanic who works out of his garage and then in his backyard. Those are the people that end up owing taxes because they don't have lobbyists in Congress and they don't have armies of CPAs and lawyers to protect them if they come up owing money. I mean, I did not start. Now, I worked my share of lawyers and doctors and professionals like that. But I never worked a company that had more than 50 employees. That just never happened.
Hmm. Thanks for the call. Those are good questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with Richard Yancey. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Richard Yancey, author of Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. Well, the first time you are in the field, it's under the tutelage of Melissa Kavanaugh, and you go to see Attorney Bernie. tell us about that. And was that kind of a typical encounter?
Yes, and that's why it's in the book. That was a typical encounter. Melissa was one of those revenue officers who were hired before the Outstanding Scholars Program. She had a high school diploma, and she had risen within the service. She had joined the service right out of high school and had risen within the service from a clerkship up into the position of senior revenue officer. And she understood the fundamental of the job, which was, we have all the power and you don't. And I always felt, and I think it comes across in that scene, that, you know, she really enjoyed it. And it was fun to her to be sitting in a lawyer's office and be barking orders at a high-powered lawyer and having him, you know, saying, jump, well, how high? And it literally happened. I mean, the guy was, you know, he looked like he had stepped out of a GQ ad. He was just dressed to the nines. He looked, you know, wonderfully. Had a perfect tan, perfect hair, perfect teeth. And by the end of that interview, he was just a quivering mess. I mean, he was just a blob of jelly in her hands. And that's what really, you know, struck all of us. And your listeners should know, this was our very first day. There were five of us new trainees. So, and the IRS usually arrives totally unexpected by the taxpayer. So we go trooping into this attorney's office, six of us strong, you know, he says, you guys are, you know, nothing short of a battalion here. You always come in so much force. And it was a pretty surreal scene because we weren't allowed to talk. Melissa specifically told us, do not say a word in this meeting. And so she did all the talking, and it just got to him after a while. The five of us sitting at this conference table just staring at him. I mean, it would be unnerving to anyone. And finally he got the message at the end that, you know, Melissa had all the power, and he was going to do absolutely everything she said, or there would be dire consequences.
Well, are there folks who get a question with a lighter hand?
Oh yes, oh yes. And for every Melissa or Culpepper, there was another revenue officer who, you know, was very gentle. Went to the other extreme. Now that kind of revenue officer never got promoted. I should make that clear. Those weren't they would be fairly secure in their jobs. It wasn't as if they were risking losing their jobs by being nice, but what they were risking were promotions and awards, because being nice never collected a lot of tax. And those nice people had cases that went on for years, because, and this is just you know the nature of the beast. The IRS sends a lot of notices and tries to make a lot of phone calls before they invest in sending the case to a revenue officer, because that takes a lot of money. That's a lot of overhead to pay someone to physically go out and try to collect tax. So those people that would react in a responsible manner to a phone call or a letter, they're not the ones that a revenue officer ends up contacting. It's those people who are reluctant to pay, who don't want to have to deal with the system, who are, you know, either so desperate that they don't know what to do, so they go totally passive, or they're so belligerent that they're not going to deal with the IRS. They don't care if the IRS camps out on their doorstep. So a nice revenue officer is not going to, you know, be able to plead or cajole a person like that into you know, getting it to the point where they can actually close their case.
Yeah. During your training, you were told, do not threaten, scold, or patronize. Is that meaningless?
It is. It was for some revenue officers. Yeah. And certainly the idea behind that is that you really don't need to. I had an instructor at one of the training seminars that we had to attend during the first year, the training year, say, you know, I never lose my temper, I never raise my voice, because I don't have to. In this game, I have all the power. I have all the cards. There's nothing to worry about. There's nothing that they can do to me that is approaches anything like what I can do to them. I will always win. And that was her attitude. I will always win. There's no need to yell. There's no need to cajole. I'm always going to win.
Hmm. Melissa was tough, but not as tough as Culpepper. Tell us something about him.
I've never met anyone like Culpepper, and I hope I never meet anyone like him again. He represented what ultimately the job could do to anyone. And it was my understanding that he was kind of a nice guy before he got hired. He was kind of a fun, silly kind of guy that was kind of a ne'er-do-well, sort of like I was, when he got hired. And the job really, really changed him. And I my regret is I never knew him before he started the IRS, because I think that would be interesting to know what he was like before he came there. But by the time I met him and he was assigned to be my on-the-job instructor, he had been fully immersed in the culture. And to me, he came to represent, you know, he was the physical embodiment of the bogeyman that everyone's terrified of. You know, what is your worst nightmare of an IRS agent? You know, most people would describe someone along the lines of Culpepper. I think he was, you know, completely seduced by the power. And I think he was so immersed in that world that he never could look, you know, outside of it. He was the kind of revenue officer who couldn't leave it at the office, who applied it to every single aspect of his life. And I'm not really sure where he is now, but I hear, the last I heard is he's done very well in the service, and he's working somewhere in Washington, D.C., which is kind of scary to think about.
Does Culpepper have family? I mean, is he married? Does he have children?
He was married at the time I knew him. Now, I lost touch with him years ago. I don't know if he's still married yet or not.
It's got to be tough on a marriage to.
It's tough on a lot of marriages. A lot of marriages. I never saw the statistics on it, but I've heard that a lot of marriages ended during revenue officer training years or the first few years into the job. And a lot of revenue officers marry other people within the service, like I did, because it is very difficult. And I'm sure this is not true just in this particular profession, but it's very difficult for a spouse that's not involved in that milieu to understand, you know, what goes on there and what it does to you. And plus, you're prohibited by law to talk about anything that goes on there, except in the most very general terms.
Let's talk with another listener. A caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm at a payphone. I'm going to have to hang up and catch this later, the answer, I mean. But I know in some big corporations, there are actually Internal Revenue agents that have their own offices within the corporate headquarters, and that they, you know, they're like continuously there. And I was curious if you knew anything, because you'd been talking about how the IRS targets the middle class a lot, but I think a lot of people don't know that they also have offices within, or at least they used to have offices within big corporations. I was wondering if you knew anything about those people, and I was particularly curious if you knew whether or not there was talk within the IRS about them possibly being co-opted by their being having to rub shoulders all the time with the people that they're continuously auditing or not or anything you might know about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, I had heard that there are revenue agents. These are different from collectors. These are the auditors. that were permanently assigned to the larger corporations. Where I did the first part of my tour down in Florida, there was one of the largest employers in the county did have a, if you will, in-house IRS employee that had their own office in the business. That I guess their purpose is to continually audit, you know, how the books are being kept to make sure everything is in compliance. I never personally, you know, ran into someone like that who did something like that, and I certainly never got a collection case based on any work that's done in-house in those big corporations. But you know, that's the only comment I can make.
Yeah. It was, you know, I don't spend very much time at all thinking about the IRS, but it's a really big agency, as you mentioned before, and there are many, many divisions. So, yeah, so there are all kinds of career opportunities.
That's right.
At the IRS. You know, thinking back to, you know, this, you know, being in the, you know, I would be on the other side of the table from somebody like Melissa or Culpepper. What kind of advice do you have for us? Should we find ourselves across the table from someone from the collection division?
Yeah, the first thing I would advise someone is to know your rights. And one of those rights has to do with right to representation. If you can afford it at all, get a professional to represent you. It's especially true if you live in a smaller area, because there's probably only a handful of CPAs around or what's called enrolled agents who can represent before the service. What that means is that these people have a, you know, we're talking about in-house close working relationships. These people usually have good working relationships with the revenue officers who work in that particular office that you've been assigned to, which means, you know, of a revenue officer, it's much harder to beat up on a CPA or a tax attorney, first by virtue of the fact that they know the law hopefully as well as you do, but secondly because after you get off the phone with this person or have a meeting with them, you're going to see them again. You're going to have to maintain some sort of working relationship with them. So that would be my first piece of advice. If there's any way at all you can afford to get someone to represent you, just for that reason alone, not to mention, it's like representing yourself, it's like having yourself as your own lawyer. You've got a fool for a client, that old saying.
Mm.
You know, a CPA or a tax attorney who has a good working relationship with the local IRS office is going to be, you know, it's going to keep your best interest at heart, and they will also approach it in a much more business-like way. When you're dealing with something like owing taxes, that's a gut-wrenching thing for most people. For most people. There's a certain percentage that they could care less. But for most people, that's pretty gut-wrenching, and it's hard for them, as it would be for anyone, to keep a level head, to disassociate themselves and to be dispassionate about it. So the first piece of advice I would give is, you know, get a professional. The second is never lie. You shouldn't lie in general, but never, never lie to the IRS. You may get away with it, but the odds are still that the IRS is very good at what it does. They are the envy of the world. And if you lie, you run a huge risk of getting caught. And if you get caught, things will not be pretty. Because even if your case gets successfully resolved, if anything comes up in the future, the IRS is going to assume that whatever you tell them is a lie. Just like I suppose when you're in any relationship. And it's like I say in the book, you know, the IRS is going to be here forever. Congress can change, you know, can change even its name. It can legislate the way it operates. But as long as we have a country, our country needs the lifeblood of taxes. And as long as there's a tax code, there's got to be some sort of agency that enforces that code. And since the IRS is forever, it's a good idea, you know, not to just jeopardize that relationship through something silly like lying about whether you have, you know, another home or a car you're not telling somebody about, or to lie in even something as simple as your deductions.
Yeah. It you know, it strikes me also that what tax collectors are taught along the way could be useful for those of us who might be facing a tax collector, and that is, you know, again, don't threaten, don't yell, you know, recognize your own attitudes and eliminate those that are counterproductive,
right,
and avoid getting trapped.
Right, and avoid getting trapped. That's what they told us. And they said, you know, never, and this is one of the rules I broke my very first case. They say never go into a kitchen. Never. Because in most people's homes, if you're going to find a weapon, you're going to find it in the kitchen. Because even if they don't keep a gun, there's going to be knives laying around and other implements, you know, that could potentially be fatal. And, of course, my very first case, like a dummy, I go walk into someone's kitchen and sit down.
Yeah. Well, there are, you know, we've talked about some scary types working for the IRS in collection, but, you know, there are some taxpayers out there or tax scofflaws who are rough customers.
Yes, pretty rough.
Yeah.
Pretty rough people. And tax collectors are not allowed to carry any sort of weapons. Any kind of weapon for obviously for your own protection would be the idea, including anything like mace or pepper spray, and especially not a gun, because you know most people have a problem with you know someone collecting taxes at the end of a gun. But the flip side of that is you do walk into situations like I mentioned earlier. You know you go in blind. The way I was trained. And this changed a little bit, but the way I was trained is, you know, it serves no purpose to make another phone call or to send another letter. You know, these people that you're dealing with have had dozens of letters and a half a dozen phone calls, so what's the purpose of you picking up the phone or sending another letter? So we went out cold. They did not know we were coming. And so you literally had no idea what you were walking into when you got there. You couldn't even check to see if the person had a criminal background. So, you know, you'd walk into situations that were potentially explosive. I talk about it, I mentioned it earlier, the nursery seizure, where I was actually assaulted by the taxpayer's son. Came to find out later that there had been a gun in the kid's truck and a loaded gun behind his seat. And I was fortunate that this kid, you know, didn't decide to use it on me. But yeah, any time you come into someone's house and you're demanding to, you know, not only entering into the house, but demanding to know the most intimate details of their lives, you're running a risk, you know, you're already sitting on a powder keg. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, most of the time, you know, the flip side of that too is that despite thinking that because I'm going to see the worst part of human nature, I'm going to come away with a kind of a dim view of human beings in general, it actually, you know, kind of reinforced my own sense that, you know, people are basically honest, decent, and if push comes to shove, we'll tell you the truth and we'll level with you and try to get things resolved.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the people I worked with, once they realized the seriousness of the situation, we're totally cooperative, and we were able to resolve, you know, whatever the problem was without, you know, taking their house or something like that.
Yeah. What did you learn in the end about yourself as a result of these 12 years with the IRS?
Well, I certainly learned that I was capable of things that you know, before I came on there that I would have denied I was even capable of. I do think one of the big reasons that I left was is that I, you know, some things about me had changed, and I wasn't too happy with them. One being that you know, I had become pretty cynical about manipulation in the workplace and in ordinary life, and I found that it was becoming increasingly difficult for me to just leave it at the office and not bring those stresses and tensions from the workplace home to my family. And part of me wishes I could tell the kid who took that job, you know, maybe you ought to think about maybe you ought to think about not showing up, you know, for your first day. Maybe you ought to think about giving this, you know, writing thing one more chance. But on the other hand, I think, you know, if I hadn't gone there, I wouldn't have learned some very valuable lessons about life and about myself, and I certainly wouldn't have met my lovely wife who worked there and who still works there, and had my lovely children, so and plus written, you know, a book about it.
Right. What does your lovely wife think of the book?
She's proud of me as a writer.
Yeah?
You know, I mentioned earlier that you know, the year since this book is published, the IRS is the people who run the IRS are not dumb, and they know that, you know, there's not much they can do about me expressing my First Amendment rights, especially when I leave service. But they do know that there is one person that, you know, that is still there. And things have not gone well for her since I left. A member of upper management appeared in her office a couple weeks after the publication of the book, and asked her, said, "Well, you know, everyone in Washington is talking about this book that your husband wrote, and are you going to be going on any of the promotional tour with him?" And she said, "Yes, I was making plans next month." And this person from Washington said, "Well, I certainly would, because, you know, I'd be very concerned about what he says in the future." And then proceeded to question her quite closely on her career plans and goals, and if she wanted to continue with the IRS or have my writing support her. And you know, it's that's what's particularly, you know, troubling to me, and based on, you know, some other things that I probably shouldn't get into on a national public radio program, but, you know, based on some other things that have happened since I left the service, you know, I really, you know, like I said about IRS targeting people or prominent people who don't particularly agree with the current administration, I certainly do think that goes on.
You know, this would make a basis for a great television series, I think. I don't know. Although, you know, you wouldn't have the redemptive part of the story couldn't kick in until the very end, though, could it?
Yeah. I have sold an option to Paramount, and I think they are trying to pitch it as a series, which I think it probably would work better as a series than, say, a motion picture. But I think they've got that same problem as figuring out, you know, how are we going to keep an audience with us while they grow to like this jerk? Or maybe they won't grow to like this jerk, but it's that problem. You know, who wants to watch a series about a bunch of tax collectors? And I think, you know, that's why people who read the book, I hope, come away with that. I think it is totally surprising, you know, the way the story is approached, and that, you know, it's not just a dry book about tax collecting. It's actually, you know, about much more than tax collecting.
It's about people.
Yeah.
Richard, we've got to wrap it up here. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Richard Yancey has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Confessions of a Tax Collector, One Man's Tour of Duty Inside the IRS. The book is now available in paperback, published by Perennial, a division of HarperCollins. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Well, actually, we're going to spin the ag wheel today, Celeste.
It's Jay Pierce.
It's going to be me probably most of this week, as Todd takes a little time off and Dave Dickey's away as well. So here we go. Let's take a look at the Board of Trade first of all for March 2005 wheats. The high price today, 309.5. The low was 305. Settlement, 306. That up 1.75. The May wheat contract had a high of 317, a low of 312.5, the settlement 313, up 1.5. July, the high 324, the low 318.5, the settlement 319, up 3/4. September wheat 329 for the high, the low was 326, the settlement 326, up 0.5. And December 05 had a high of 340, a low of 335, the settlement 336, up 2. March corn, the high 208, the low 205.5, the settlement 206.5, up 2. May, the high 215.25, the low 213, the settlement 211.75, up 2.25. July, the high 222.75, the low 220.5, the settlement 219.5, up 2. September had a high of 230, a low of 228, the settlement 226.75, up 2.5. December 05, 239.5 was the high, the low 237.5, the settlement 236.5, that up 1.5. In March 2006, corn closed up 2, the high was 246.5, the low 245, the settlement 244, again up 2. March oats had a high of 159.5, low of 155.5, and the settlement 157.5, down 0.5. May oats, 156.5 the high, the low was 153, the settlement 155.5 unchanged on the close. January soybeans had a high of 566, a low of 547, the settlement 550, up 1.25. March had a high of 561, a low of 544.5, the settlement 548.5, up 4.5. May soybeans had a high of 558.5, a low of 548.5, the settlement 552.5, up 5.5. July had a high of 565, a low of 555, the settlement 558.25, up 5.75. August soybeans had a high of 563, the low was 556.5, the settlement was 560.5, up 5.5. And September 05 soybeans, the high today 565, the low 560, the settlement 561, up 8 on the close. Soybean meal for January, the high today 165, the low 158.70, the settlement 160.10, up 130. And the March meal contract, 165 was the high, the low was 158.70, the settlement was 159.70, up 80. January soybean oil, the high 2105, the low 2080, the settlement 2087, up 26. And the March oil contract, the high today 21.15, the low 20.87, the settlement 20.97, up 28. And now back to Celeste for a look at how things wrapped up on the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, well, it looks like feeder cattle finished higher, while the hogs and bellies finished lower today on the Mercantile Exchange. January feeders 103.90, the high 103.15, the low 103.32.5, the settlement that up 7.5. March 99.70, the high 99.12.5, the low 99.67.5, the settlement that up 50. April 98.15, the high 97.60, the low 98.02.5, the settlement that up 50. December live cattle 88.95, the high 88.40, the low 88.57.5, the settlement that up 22.5. February 90.50, the high 89.60, the low 89.72.5, the settlement that down 12.5. February lean hog 74.25, the high 73 even, the low 73.10, the settlement that down 75. April 72.47.5, the high 71.35, the low 72.20, the settlement unchanged. May 70.90, the high 69.90, the low 70.50, the settlement that down 85. June 73.10, the high 71.80, the low 72.37.5, the settlement that down 82.5. And February bellies 99.15, the high 97.05, the low 97.27.5, the settlement finishing down 50 cents. The Dow is up 15 points at 10,665. The NASDAQ off 7 at 2128. And the S&P 500 is up a fraction at 1194.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Risk Management Commodities, who will be presenting an ag marketing seminar at the University Inn in West Lafayette, Indiana at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Tuesday, December 21st. Reservations or more information at 866-837-9027.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Andrew Pooser from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho writes, Dear Dr. Science, three sailors...